stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hey everyone, Andrew here. A couple weeks ago, we told you we were looking into doing a KnitCast meetup in Atlantic City at the end of November during the Borgata Fall Poker Open, and we've just finalized our plans. I figured it would be best just to get this announcement out as soon as possible so that you can start making your plans to meet us there. So, we'll be meeting on Saturday, November 23rd at 10 a.m. in the cafeteria area that's like in the basement of the Borgata. If you've never been there before, there's an escalator near the poker room that leads down into a cafeteria, and there are a number of different food and drink options down there. We'll be there roughly 10 a.m. to noon, so you can come by, get breakfast with us, get lunch, get coffee, just hang out, or just stop in and say hello. We'll be glad to see you either way. Yes, 10 a.m. is a little early for the average poker player's schedule, but you know what? There are going to be tournaments and cash games running all day, and we didn't want to conflict with anything that you might be playing. So, you know, we're worth it. Come by a little earlier maybe than you're used to getting up. Or maybe our crowd is somewhat more skewed towards the early risers. Anyway, I'm going to be there. Carlos Welch is going to be there. Sean Lango is going to be there. Hopefully some other guests we've had on the show will have to try to round those up. Yeah, if you have questions about how the show is edited or you want to tell Sean that the music on the show rocks, you should do that. He was our guest recently on the show, and he's a member of Palmyra, which is the band that performs the music that you hear on the show. I've actually never met Sean in person myself, so I'm looking forward to that. The only bad news is that Nate most likely will not be there. I know that's going to be a disappointment to all the ladies out there, and I just want to say that I will be there to comfort you in your disappointment about not being able to meet Nate. If you are not able to make it to the meetup, but you're going to be in Atlantic City, Carlos and I will be there actually from the night of Wednesday the 20th through at least Monday the 25th. So you should tweet at us at Thinking Poker, let us know that you're going to be out there, and find a way to come say hello even if you're not able to make it to the meetup. Okay? So that's going to be November 23rd, 10 a.m. to noon in the downstairs cafeteria at the Borgata in Atlantic City. We hope to see you there. I also want to give you a heads up that this week's episode is a little different than some. Gareth Chandler is our guest. You probably know he's been on the show a couple of times before. And the flow of the conversation is a little more like old friends catching up and a little less like a proper interview. We definitely do talk about poker. We talk about triple draw. We talk about Zoom poker strategy-wise. We talk about Gareth's new job with Full Tilt Poker. But we also get pretty far afield talking about literature, about David Foster Wallace, about a little Twitter spat that I had with Ricky Gervais recently. And really, it's just going to be more like listening into a conversation that revolves vaguely around poker. I realize that will be of less interest to some people than others, so I figured I would give you that heads up now. Also, this episode does more to warrant an explicit tag than most of our shows do, so probably not the best one to listen to at work or in front of your kids. Sorry, I do realize that's an inconvenience for some of you, and Nate and I really are working to use profanity only when we feel like it actually serves a purpose and not just casually. But, you know, there is some mention of Ricky Gervais in this episode. So, among other things, there are going to be a couple of C-bombs thrown around. Just wanted to give you all fair warning. Okay, enjoy the show, and we'll hope to see you in Atlantic City.
Hello and welcome to episode 53 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Gareth Chandler from Trondheim, Norway, and with me is Andrew Brokus and Nate Mavis.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Well done, Gareth.
Was that Mavis-esque enough for you guys?
I don't know if it was Mavis-esque because I don't usually have third personal access to these things, but it sounded pretty good to me, and I'm sure our listeners are happy to hear you.
Oh, happy to be back on the show after it's been a little while, I guess.
Everybody praise Gareth for the bring-in because he was really nervous about that before we went on air. He said he had to focus himself and collect himself and that he wouldn't know what to do. So we need positive reinforcement for the introduction. Nice job, Gareth.
Not everyone has the vocal, you know, capacities of some of the people who regularly host the show. So.
So we also made Gareth postpone telling a possibly funny story until we got on the air. So Gareth, are you going to the LAPT in November?
Yeah, I'm supposed to be. I'm kind of doing a favor for Brad so listen to this route that I'm taking because this is easily the craziest travel schedule I've done yet. I'm flying Trondheim, Norway to Berlin, and then the next day, and I'm going to grind like a Sunday, and then the next day I'm going to wake up early, fly Berlin, Munich, Munich, Philly, then Philly, Miami, then Miami, Lima, then Lima, Montevideo. And then I'm going to take like a cab for an hour and a half to get to this venue.
Wow.
Yeah, so it wasn't originally that way. Like originally I was going to catch Philly to Montreal and it was part of my return ticket from an earlier flight. But yeah, I got asked to do this tournament and just sort of jostled the flights as best we could so that I could get there on time.
Tell me you're saving more than $200 by taking that route.
Yeah, I am doing some knitcast worthy things on the flights, that's for sure. I got a stipend or an allowance for travel and I was like over $200 under budget on the flight, so
very good.
Pretty pumped about that.
You get to keep the difference on that, I assume.
Nope. Just being a quality freelance employee.
Wow.
If anybody in a supervisory position over Gareth hears this, you should give Gareth that money, okay?
Half of it would be fair.
Yeah.
Brad,
really,
everybody wins.
Really. Or buy him some drinks or something. That is above and beyond. I can say, like, look, if I am ever employing you, Gareth, and I'm ever paying you a travel allowance to go somewhere, just use it up. I will give you the money if you get under that. Like, that's amazing. I'm just saying.
These things don't always work out as well as you want. Like, I went to Ireland, as you guys know, for 17 days, and I had a per diem that you can spend on food and things like that. And let's just say it was not a KnitCast approved per diem. So, but the thing is, you can't keep the difference. You've got to have the receipts and you bill the people. So you can't keep the difference on per diem and you're incentivized to spend it all.
Right.
So I was going.
That's all your pay, right? Like they pay you this. They like, oh, you know, have a good fun in Galway, right? Like that's part of the, like there's no obligation to spend as little as possible, right?
Right. I mean, so they take care of you and, you know, you have some perks while you're there. You're not grumpy. The problem is then you're running around the tournament floor and trying to bang out your best copy, you know, without supervision after eating like brack of lamb for lunch or something. Like, especially when Anna came for like 6 days. And we were going out to these restaurants and then I was going to work for like 13 hours and I just realized I'm just going to spend like $20 and get 3 12-inch subs and just, you know, forget the rest. Like, it's not worth it. I'm just too tired. I'm just, you know.
I can't keep spending money.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to talk them down from the per diem on the next job. Because I'm like, I can't spend this much money so recklessly, you know. But no can do. Couldn't get them to budge on the per diem.
And just it occurs to me there might be some people who don't know entirely who you are or what you're talking about. So these are per diems that you're getting for covering events for Full Tilt Poker and PokerStars.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, everybody, right. New listeners, this is Gareth Chandler. This is a crazy person we're friends with. He's been on the show before, one of the early episodes. You can hear about his life story. He's an interesting guy. And he's a friend of the pod. He's not just a guest. He's a friend of the podcast. And he goes around writing about poker tournaments and blogging. And he's like an instructor for like poker school online. And he does all kinds of things. And that's Gareth. But now he should tell you about his life.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much it. And yeah, I literally tried to negotiate a smaller per diem, but did so unsuccessfully. So I think, you know, some of my life decisions might not be Knitcast approved, but I think I should still wear that badge. I'm pretty proud. Yeah, I'm going to be writing full time for the Full Tilt blog now in like a strategy capacity. Actually had a meeting with my supervisor yesterday where it was today, actually. I'm going to be doing like a post a day, and I was worried that I was going to be doing these filler posts that are like daily recap of the Sunday tournaments or whatever in between. Go ahead.
Like obvious SEO link bait where like you have to use the name. So like you have to use at least 25 nouns from the following list in every one of your posts, and they all have to link somewhere.
Yeah, they are going to be there is going to be some like SEO optimization, and they actually have some, I don't know if I can talk about what measures they use, so I'll just say that they measure like website interaction.
Yeah. Or if you don't know, listeners, if you don't know, Gareth can't say, if you don't know and you're curious, Google SEO optimization and read about it for 5 minutes. And then go to PokerStars.com and read the little text on the bottom and the sides of the screen and also like the central content, and you'll start to get an idea. Go on, Gareth.
Oh, so where was I going with this? I was worried that I was going to be writing a lot of these filler posts in between doing the interesting strategy posts. But my supervisor was saying, well, you know, these like recaps don't even really do that well. We're not like wed to you doing, you know, these summary or these filler or these repetitive things. So you can pretty much like give us strategy content like every day of the week if you can manage. So it's going to be a bit of a tall task because like Isildur is playing deuce to seven triple draw and I know exactly nothing about deuce to seven triple draw, much less whatever insane stakes that they're playing. So there are going to be some challenges, but at the same time, like I basically have a lot of room to come up with innovative, or not really innovative, but just creative ways to present strategic content in, you know, in a meaningful way. It's not just going to be like, these are the top 10 starting hands, you know, it's going to be as deep as I want. So yeah, I can really just go to town, and I'm going to have to learn a lot in terms of, talking about some of the other games. So mostly I'm going to just try and access people with expert knowledge to, you know, come in, you know, whether it's like interview or just to give me background or just to pick people's brains. But, you know, it's an exciting, it's stuff I want to write and they're paying me to do it. So, I mean, and I can do it in my underwear. you know, how great is this? This is like, dream situation, dream scenario.
Could I suggest trying to record some of these conversations where you pick the brains of smart non-Hold'em players, either with us participating or just you recording them either for your own use or for use on the show? I think there's a lot of people who would be interested in hearing this.
Right, so you're some crossover synergy. If we could SEO optimize those, that would just...
Sure.
I definitely, like, Gus is playing this guy Cottonseed at 08, and Isildur is winning millions of dollars at Triple Draw, and I've got to write about it at some point in the next 8 weeks. So, yeah, definitely. I'm down for any ideas like that.
Maybe we'll try to get you and Talonchik on the show at the same time, and we can all powwow about 08.
I'll bring the hand histories, that's for sure.
Yeah. Look, I haven't won millions of dollars at poker, but I did play deuce to seven for some pretty real stakes for a while there. So you should feel free to ask me about that if you like. So.
Oh, did you really? I knew you were a connoisseur, a Renaissance man of games, but I didn't know deuce to seven was in that mix. So that's, that's great. That's interesting.
I mean, mostly live, so mostly against people who were... let's just say I wasn't playing against Poker Snowy in the games I was playing, but I thought a lot about the game, and I've done pretty okay at the game not for huge stakes, but solidly into the mid, well into the mid stakes. How about that? So
you've become that's what we call a callback podcast, people, a callback. You've become a grizzled podcast veteran after, you know, merely a year at work. Yes. I don't even know equities, so you're going to be miles ahead. Like you're a huge resource if you're interested in looking at a hand.
I don't know how much preparation you feel like you would need, but I mean, I'd be all for doing that now if you guys are up for it.
Yeah, I can tell you a complete. Here's how you play deuce to seven triple. Okay, when you're in position, raise after the second draw and keep on raising until the other person stops raising. And then if that person pats, you break. And if that person breaks, then you pat. And you're pretty much guaranteed to be okay. That's all you need to know.
Like, I'm wondering how people get bluffs through after the third draw, after all the draws are out. Like, how do, like, you get an amazing price on a bluff, but how does it ever work? I don't know.
Well, because sometimes the other person has a bad hand. But your hand is even worse. So, like, I mean, sometimes the other person has a pair of deuces, but you have a pair of fives. And, I mean, not that the person's necessarily going to fold the pair of deuces, but that's okay. You know, like, sometimes they will. And so if it goes draw, draw, then, you know, there are equilibria. And the other person can't call every time. I mean, so you get bluffs through the same way you get bluffs through in any other game, fundamentally, right? I mean, it plays out a little bit differently because it can either be, you know, break, 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 pat, or pack, pat, or break, pat in the other direction. But if you're value betting, if you're doing strong, thin value betting, the way that you're doing strong, thin value betting in other games. So, for example, often if it goes break, break, check, and the pot is pretty big, and you picked up a queen or a king, there are a lot of situations where you should go ahead and bet. And if you're making all the bets you're supposed to be making with jacks and queens and hands like that, then you're pretty good. and if you're drawing smooth so that you're not making a lot of straights, so that, you know, that actually turning those four outs into good hands instead of straights, you know, that helps you get bluffs through. Also, it strengthens your range. So yeah, by value betting correctly, basically is how you get bluffs to work.
Yeah, I would imagine too that, I mean, kind of the same way you could ask, like, well, how is it the continuation betting can work so much in Hold'em? I mean, don't people realize that sometimes they should continue with their hand even though they missed the flop? And, I mean, the answer is maybe now they do after years of having that pounded into their head. But, I mean, there's still plenty of people who just kind of play like, well, I didn't hit the flop, so I'm going to fold. And I think a fair number of people think about the river and triple draw the same way, where they're like, well, he raised on the last draw, so he must have a good hand. And I'm drawing to a good hand, but I didn't make it, so I'm going to fold.
I'm sure there are equilibria everywhere, like Nate said. So that does make a lot of sense to me. Nate, can I ask, like, what's a more ideal situation to turn a hand into a bluff when you, like, start with a really smooth hand that, like, becomes a straight over, like, two bad draws, I guess? Or if you, like, start rough and maybe, I don't know, pair your best card or something like that.
That's a really good hand. So, or that's really good. That's a really good question. So caveat, I haven't played a hand of triple draw in years, but for at least 1 year. But so you want to think about times when your range is strong, but your hand is weak. So let's say a player raises and you three bet with a one card draw. And often you're going to play all your one card draws the same pre-draw. So let's say your range is a little bit tighter than usual because the original raiser is tighter than usual. But as it happens, this time you have deuce 3, 4, 5. Well, that's not a good example, but deuce 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
Okay. You'd rather not have the six, but under some conditions, it'll, you know, what are you going to do? Not keep the six? I mean, sometimes there's an argument for that, but let's say you don't. Then,
I mean, if we're playing shorthanded, like, you know, you can't pick and choose those cards, right?
That's right. That's right. Or actually, the example will work better if it, you know, let's say it's a loser player who opens and you three bet a two card draw or something like that, or you somehow get to the first draw with a two card draw, and it's deuce 4, 5, and then your head's up to the first draw. And it goes bet, and then you call, even though you hit trip fours. Or no, let's say you hit trip fours. You know, so it goes 5, 4, 4, 4, deuce. And somehow you get to the next draw. Maybe you start taking aggressive action or not. And then the other person draws two again. Okay. So yeah. Maybe check, bet, call. So now the other person's drawing two. And you're going to have a pretty good hand a lot of the time here. Like, you know, let's say you're pretty tight pre-flop. Let's just say you know that your range is pretty good. And as it happens, you can see 5 low cards, 5, 4, 4, 4 deuce. You can see a lot of the deck. You know that the original raiser is loose. You know that they're still drawing. And because they drew two, even if you hit like, let's say like a rough jack, like jack 10, 5, 4 deuce, something like that, like you could well decide.
Can't value bet.
Well, I mean, I guess maybe with a jet. Well, see, this is where I'm rusty, but I think there will be a lot of hands that you'll want to just stay pat with and then bet the turn with anyway. So you can just pretend that you have one of those hands. So you have a nice wide value range, and you can just pretend that you have one of the hands. So you have a strong range and a weak hand, and you have good card removal. So then you can just snow.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So it seems like
you just draw to blockers to a strong hand and your hand becomes like invalid in terms of its potential versus how well you can bluff with it.
Yeah.
And your range is strong, like you say.
Yeah. And there have to be more ingredients, and you have to be able to represent something, right? Like you actually would say, look, this guy could have a hand like 6-5-3 here, maybe, or 6-5 deuce or something like that. And maybe he just bricked off, but he thinks he's getting too good of a price. So he called one small bet after the first draw. You know, you really would just hang on to your jack pretty often there and let him try to outdraw you, right? So like, you know, even if I'm wrong by one notch on some of the details, because I haven't played this game in a year, you know, the ingredients are still there. You have a wide range and a weak hand in it and good card removal, and you can plausibly represent that you would play the stronger hands in the same way. Very, very important. So once you get used to putting together ranges like that, then you can, so that's a canonical sort of example. Excuse me.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Man, this is just going to be an undertaking, though. Lot to learn. Because, I mean, these articles are going to go live, you know, to the blog, so.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, like, how much do you have to write every day? So is it, like, 300 words 6 days a week, something like that?
It's 5 days a week, and the average word count is about 300 words, yeah. But it's going to be vacillating between, like, 200 and 500. Per day. So all there's right. going to be shorter pieces and then longer pieces.
All right. And they have to be good, but they don't have to be Joyce or anything, right? Like this is a doable job. Yes.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like Concision here is like my friend. It seems to me, I can write a lot of hands. I can write 500 words reasonably quickly and reasonably concisely. It seems to me like if I had to write 2,000 words concisely, I would start to really, you know, not perform well over a day. But yeah, I think it's doable. Yeah. Some things that I'm not as well suited to it as others. Like, you know, I'm writing up Hold'em hand analysis. I just feel like I'm in my element. But you know, triple draw is a whole nother thing that I've never actually played, you know, like I've played single draw deuce to seven, but I've never actually played triple draw. So yeah.
Do you think it would be acceptable for you to like adopt the persona of a person who's learning the game and post your comments in a kind of speculative voice? Like, it seems like maybe what Isildur was thinking was, or I mean, do you have to come out authoritatively? Like, he made a good play by snowing here because blah, 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 and like pretend you know what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, I think certainly what they expect from, like, there's going to be content on Courchevel and like Irish and all these games where the general knowledge base of the readership is, you know, very low. Like, they're not going to expect me to write a deuce to triple draw article that, you know, Galfond can look over and nod with approval. They want me to write to most of the people who are visiting the website. So I don't need to have, like, no limit expertise. I don't need to be able to say, oh, well, you know, he check called with bottom pair and backdoor clubs because he wants to be protected. He wants to be protected on all club runouts from the, you know, triple barrel range. Like I can say that about No Limit and expect some of the readership to maybe glaze their eyes over, but for the most part, people are going to appreciate that. And then I assume what I myself find insightful about triple draw is also going to be the kind of insights that people appreciate. So I just have to do some work to gather those insights, basically.
So just being able to explain like why on earth someone would call a river bet with queen high might be sufficient.
Yeah, yeah. Or like why someone might break a made hand, or yeah, like just like the general concept of like why you would, not specific to the case, saying editorially this was, you know, 30% of the time an error in all likelihood, but or whatever. I'd just say generally this is the idea behind breaking a made queen or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah,
Nate, I'm curious to know, how did you go about learning triple draw yourself? I mean, did you play first, or did you work out math first?
I played a little bit first. So there wasn't really any material on it. A little bit on the 2+2 forums, but even almost none back in the day. And then it was, I believe, the spring of 2005 when Super System 2 came out with Dan Negreanu's chapter on Deuce to Seven. And I'm sure we could look back now and think of ways where that chapter was inadequate, but like Daniel's a pretty smart guy, and there was a lot of good content in that chapter, especially by 2005 standards. And so I studied that very, very intensely. And you know, I didn't have a whole lot of people to play with. I would sometimes cajole some of my college buddies into playing it with me. And you know, I would work out some of the arithmetic by hand, but yeah, I would basically read Daniel's book, then play it on Ultimate Bet for a while. And you know, I mean, I was a beginner, you know. It's like, how can I ever fold the queen? The pot is big, he might be bluffing. And then I was like, well, really, is he bluffing? Like, and then, you know, there are some people who just don't snow. They just don't snow. And especially, it was 2005. There were people who didn't four bet before the flop without aces and hold them. And there were people who just didn't stand pat without a made hand on second straight. So it's like, oh, well, if he's not snowing, then he can't be bluffing, so I can fold my queen, you know, then I can stop being such a pay station. And it's like, oh, well, that's how ranges work. Like, well, what if I wanted to snow? How would I do that? Like, well, maybe I should think of a spot when my range is good, you know? Maybe I should think of a spot when, you know, the other person might have just bricked off, you know? It's like, oh, okay, So then there are going to be times when somebody has a lot of weak hands in his range because the pot is a little bit bloated before the flop. So they have to call a small bet, even if they totally bricked off on the first draw. And in fact, you know, just from a Bayesian perspective, that's pretty likely. It's like, oh, I guess that's a pretty big part of this game, right? Is thinking about times when the pot's a little bit bloated and, you know, you have to call that little small bet on the flop, even though you've bricked off twice. And then, you know, it's like, oh, well, maybe actually, even though I'm getting a good price, I'm out of position and my hand's face up. So maybe I can't get away with that call against a good player who's just going to barrel me and snow me sometimes and play strong against that. So, I mean, long story short, it's just sort of poker principles plus, you know, plus making all the same mistakes. Like, you know, I just paid off every bet with no pair for a while. I might be bluffing, you know? And they're like, well, maybe then you just sort of start to think about the game. You start to construct ranges. And then some of the people who seem tough at first, it's like, oh, that person just spazzes out sometimes. And sometimes he actually has it. But really what this person does is just for fun, six bets after the first draw with any made hand, with any pat hand, where that can include a queen. And then just keeps on betting all the way down. And sometimes he checks after the last draw. You know, so like all these people who seem like super tough and tricksy. And again, it's a lot like Hold'em, right? Where like, it's like, oh, I never know what he has. One time I put in eight big bets with him and he turned out that he actually had the nuts, you know? And then you start to think like, whoa, how often does that guy really hit the Jack-Jack-4 flop if he's playing like this before the flop and he's check-raising me every time on the Jack-Jack-4 flop? And maybe that's different from when he's playing every hand and he check-raises me on the Queen-Jack-8 flop. He actually has something pretty often then if he's playing like this before the flop. And similarly, it's like, oh, well, that person just drew three cards and then, you know, it was a heads-up pot, not a three-handed pot. And so maybe when he puts in that fifth bet after the first draw, I shouldn't be so scared, and I should just close my eyes and call down with my 10. But, you know, but not call down too fast, make him think he can bluff me. You know, it's so I learned like I learned every other poker game. I would have been even better if I had gotten a game theory textbook and constructed ranges perfectly. But, you know, I sort of learned it iteratively and situation by situation. And then after a while, I started to glue the situations together. Yeah, exactly. And then after a while, you glue the situations together and you start to think like, oh, and then, you know, it's cool. One day you wake up and it's like, oh, here I am after the second draw. And I'm just naturally thinking about the ranges from pre-draw and after the first draw. And I'm thinking about how to play this hand out on the next street. And, you know, you just sort of have an idea of things. Then I showed up at the Bellagio one day with money in my pocket, and I walked up to the 4080 mix game, and I didn't know what games they were playing. And I said, sir, and that sir turned out to be Boba, one of my favorite people in the Bellagio poker room, because, I don't know, he's just flamboyant in a wonderful way. And I said, oh, that's a 4080 mix game. What games are those? And he said, ah, deuce to seven, triple draw, 08, and stud high low regular. And it was like, oh, okay, those are games I fare pretty well against if the other people aren't very good. Yeah, so I sat down. Of course, I lost all the money in my pocket that day, but I did pretty well in that game for the rest of my life. So, yeah, I don't know. Nothing that exciting, just some theory, some practice, some theory, some practice. And one day you wake up, and I mean, I'm sure your average 10-20 player on PokerStars who's a winning regular could probably beat me pretty soundly now. But back then, you know, knowing that much about triple draw and having an idea, you know, that much about ranges, that was enough to do pretty well. And even though the game is high variance, it's not so high variance when everybody else is playing with their hands face up, right? So that's sometimes literally, sometimes they, you know, it's like how people think that the point of Badoogie is to make a Badoogie. Sometimes like people draw two in triple draw, and then they get two aces back, and they think, oh my goodness, I got pocket aces, and it wasn't even Hold'em. And then to like sort of share their bad luck with everybody, they just immediately fling them toward the dealer face up, which if you're in a friendly game, nobody says anything about. But yeah, they actually do play some of their cards face up and you know, choose their discards out of turn and things like that. Anyway, that's my answer. That's how I learned triple draw.
Stellar. Yeah. Can anyone be flamboyant in a bad way? That's was my main question that I wanted to interject, but refrained.
But I mostly haven't refrained before interjecting this episode. So good self restraint there. I don't know, Cristiano Ronaldo, maybe, flamboyant in a bad way. Yeah.
Lost on Andrew, sports reference.
I knew it was a sports reference, though.
Yeah.
He's a football player, right?
Yes, he's an immensely, immensely talented soccer player. Also, just detestable to a lot of people. I think it's, you know,
the poker star, like the poker star's sports friends, right?
Oh, is he? I didn't think so. No, they didn't.
No,
who am I confusing him with?
You're confusing him with a man of the same name, Ronaldo, who's a Brazilian star.
I was right for the wrong reasons. I was all along. I was thinking you were talking about Ronaldo.
No.
Yeah, Ronaldo is famous for winning the Golden Boot, I think, at the 2000 World Cup, 96. Oh,
I would guess 96.
Commenters are going to destroy me.
Wait. The World Cup is next year in 2014.
So it might be 90.
There were World Cups, so I would think 1998. You can split the difference, then you'll actually be in the year where there was a World Cup. So
you could tell how much of a football soccer fan I am.
I'm not really one, by the way. I just sort of happened.
You know how to count every 4 years?
Yeah. I don't like really follow soccer, but like I think it's hard to like sports at all and not sort of like watching the occasional soccer game just because of how wonderful those people are at the game and how exciting it can be. So, yeah. Anyway, so that's how you be flamboyant badly. Be like Cristiano Ronaldo.
This is great. I'm going to have to re-listen to that for, you know, for homework, for research, for the job.
You should also feel free to run articles by me if you'd like me to read them. I definitely would. I'm happy to help you if you want to talk to me about this.
I'm glad we're getting this in the public sphere. I'm going to hold you to it.
I mean, I may insist that some of it happen on air so that I can, multitask with this. But if Andrew's okay with that.
Encouraged.
Can you guys think of a better job? Like, really, I can do it from anywhere in the world. This is kind of like what I was telling Andrew.
And 500 words a day is nothing.
Oh, for me especially. Like, for me, it's just absolutely.
It's like an hour of work.
I didn't want that point to come up.
So you say full-time job. Does that mean that you have to do it every day
Right. There may be a full-time aspect to the job. So some part of the job is full-time. I mean, you can intuit what you will from that. If the work isn't full time, then the adjective phrase applies somewhere else. So, I'm pretty much. I was telling Andrew this in Montreal. Like things can't. Like it's all downhill from here. Things cannot get better. I just have to pause and enjoy this point on the mortal coil before the. March to the shuffling off.
That's precisely what I was thinking, Gareth, while we were having breakfast in Montreal. I was like, this is it. This is the pinnacle of my existence. And after having breakfast with Gareth Chantler, it can only get worse.
If that's not a Foster Wallace little, thing you should write up, my breakfast.
The best moment in Gareth Chandler's life. like he had the pancakes.
Apparently, we did finally get Gareth to read supposedly fun thing.
Oh, what'd you think?
Yeah, I started. It's not like I was holding out or something. I just had the time. It was really. Well, I also started Infinite Jest, despite Andrew's warnings against reading it on a plane. But supposedly fun thing, first of all, was just a lot of fun. But like I said to Andrew, I think he's a bit more. I mean, the main thing I disagree with is, I agree with all the existential angst, but I disagree that enjoyable things are like some sort of, pushing aside or willfully forgetting or you know, a variety of escapist tactics or a variety of...
it wasn't enjoyable things in general. It was specifically at the cruise. That's why like two-thirds of that essay is like breaking down all the packaging and marketing and everything, like specifically of the cruise experience as, you know, like, and that's why the cruise sort of set off the existential dread, right? Like, there's no claim in that essay to the effect that enjoyable things are generally just a way to forget about the fact that you're going to die.
I don't know. I think he kind of starts off, I would kind of disagree, I mean, with the way he starts off. He starts off really heavy. Like, he's like, these are the existential things that are terrible. And then, but I agree, like, obviously, obviously part of the essay is showing that of the enjoyable things that may be on your, like, menu, these things on the cruise ship are actually really, really terrible compared to, you know, fulfilling or potentially fulfilling or less unfulfilling, you know, enjoyable things. So, like, I it's not like I disagreed with his criticism of, you know, the blatant materialism or the unsatisfying, like, self-fulfilling ideas behind the rat race, that kind of thing. Like, obviously, I agree with all those. But it just seemed kind of like he was just a bit more pessimistic than I am, I guess, despite we agreeing on the, you know, terrible vanishing that's going to occur, you know, quite imminently. Yeah, but I mean, the writing is great. It was a lot more fun to read about him interacting with other people after a while, because like his time spent alone, you sort of knew what was going to, you know, be his musings or whatever. But when he was like playing ping pong against the guy, or, you know,
chess with
making
the girl.
Friends over the, yeah, chess with the girl is Andrew's favorite, and understandably so. Or making friends with the woman at his dinner table in their mutual hatred of the other woman's, you know, childish behavior. You know, all that stuff is really good, and you could tell he just, you know, is really technically strong. I mean, extremely technical. Like, you know, when you start Infinite Jest, you just get a real feeling for that. Like, oh, like, supposedly fun thing is... this is like Cole's notes, basically. Like, if you want to really read someone put on a virtuoso performance, like, man, like this. Oh, and the copy I got had the I don't know if it was wittingly or unwittingly pretentious preamble of this guy who is a pretty famous writer in
Dave Eggers. Himself.
Yeah, he said.
Fuck Dave Eggers.
This is another example of things you'll only hear on the Thinking Poker podcast and not on any other poker podcast.
So this preamble, he writes the sentence. Now, first of all, I don't want to brag, but I did pretty well on the English portion of the SATs, which is strictly a vocab, or when I took it was strictly a vocabulary test. And I consider myself, you know, to have a reasonable vocabulary. And yeah, this Dave Eggers guy wrote a sentence that was like, one of the good things about Infinite Jest is you don't have to reach for the dictionary every like page. And I was like, what? Like, there are so many words here that I'm sorry, like, I'm just going to admit, I don't even have the faintest clue what they mean.
Yeah.
And there's this Kindle paradox where they have this built-in dictionary. You can scroll to the word and it gives you a definition. But every word in the book that I need to know, they don't have.
I had exactly the same experience reading Infinite Jest on my Kindle.
I have in my copies of David Foster Wallace's books, like occasionally on the page, there's a list of words on in the margin that are the words I don't know. Then when the list got long enough, I would just go to the dictionary and look up them all.
that is that aggregate technique. That is what I need to add for the next 82% of the book.
Okay, so first off, there are some people who don't like the profanity, and I'm trying to only use it when it's really appropriate. But Dave Eggers, okay, 10th anniversary edition of Infinite Jest, and he's writing the prologue, right? And this fucking guy, never mind that the whole preamble is about how there are some people who produce these very large, who take on these very large tasks, like Sufjan Stevens or Sufjan or however you pronounce his name. He's trying to record an album, one album for all the 50 states. And, oh, it's such a big thing. And it's so cool to see him try to do it. And, oh, look at David Foster Wallace. He wrote this really big book. And it's a big book, but I've read it several times. And the thing about these people is that they're inspiring to me or something. And so you have this like virtuoso thing, this amazing book. And this guy who is, and I'm going to steal a line from one of my friends here, but it's true. He's everything that's wrong with his generation, Dave Eggers, okay? And he's claiming that this amazing piece of art is somehow only good because the enormity of the task, not that it was successful. He does that snotty thing where he says it's not that good because, of course, his work is better than David Foster Wallace's. It's only good because it makes he, Dave Eggers, you know, feel somehow inspired to go write his crappy postmodern vomiting all over the place. It inspires me to go, you know, write random things and leave blank pages and have little guides to read how my book, you know. That fucking guy. Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, yeah, his work really contextualizes the world that I work in, and my great art. He said, like, one caveat that I thought you left out, which was worth adding on, which was like, and all this from someone under 35, amazing. Like, oh my God, really? Like, come on.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. Just to be clear, I've read Infinite Jest more than once, well more than once. I've only read the preamble once because it's not worth spending any more time reading it, but it just like, it scarred me. It was so pretentious and terrible. Did you read that The Circle thing in the New York Times? You know, it's about, so Dave Eggers, he's writing this long novel these days where he's taking possibly the most interesting thing in the world right now, which is like the future of communication and privacy and democracy in a world where Google and Facebook and Apple exist, right? And he's somehow managing to make it like, you know, Office Space, but less psychologically insightful. Like, and of course everybody's all excited about it because, you know, it's so clever. It's not good at all. I can't believe I managed to make it to the end, but that's about it. That fucking guy. I disapproved of it. So, Dave Eggers is the name you're looking for. Sorry, you were talking, Gareth, you were going to say something about the preamble and you were reaching for the name of the person who wrote it. And it's
impossible. That was 20 minutes ago.
Gareth, I think it's possible that the name you're looking for might have been a certain Dave Eggers. Would you like to go on with your sentence now?
It's okay, Andrew. The only person still listening to this is Leo Wolfer. Don't need to worry about digressions or anything like that. I have similar sentiments about the preamble, but I was still at like a level of ignorance where I couldn't make a full diagnostic like you did. So, yeah, plus one. But like the words, I don't know. I'm just looking at the page I'm on, and he uses locomotival, tornadic, somatic.
Tornadic.
I mean, and those are like the easy ones in the of the big denuded. I happen to know what fallow, denuded, somatic, and I can guess that locomotival. Yeah. You know. Over fertilized is the last word. He just has great. He has some great analogies that I wonder how long it took him sometimes to think of the analogy. Like he must have. He's like, I need an analogy here, and I'm gonna go on and I'm gonna think about this analogy for like 2 weeks, and because like the analogies that are in there are just nailed so tight. Adding prefixes and suffixes to words and stuff like that where you wouldn't, in just a creative way, just in ways that haven't I haven't seen written before. You know, so I think, I know you said earlier in the podcast canon that some people throw infinite jest. I mean, I'm on page 100 of 1,079, and it's just been a barrel of fun so far. It's a lot of fun.
It gets better, too. The first 100 pages are not nearly the best.
Like, it's just, I don't know. It's just enjoyable and whimsical, and I don't know. Yeah.
Have you guys read Jonathan Franzen's essay about Wallace?
No, I haven't. Is it good?
On the whole, there's just a funny anecdote about the vocabulary bit where Franzen says he was out to dinner with Wallace, and I don't know if it was Wallace's wife or just a woman he was dating at the time, and Franzen's girlfriend, and Franzen's girlfriend was in the bathroom, and Wallace says something to Franzen along the lines of, like, she really is the epitome of womanhood to me. And Wallace's girlfriend kind of looks at him like, what the hell? And Franzen says, and then Wallace, who has perhaps the largest vocabulary of any person who I know, says with a straight face, it occurs to me that I've never known the exact definition of the word epitome.
It's a great story.
While we're throwing the profanity filter out the window, Ricky Gervais called me a cunt today.
Oh, really? How'd that go?
On Twitter.
Oh, that's amazing.
It'd be better if it weren't on Twitter, but it's still amazing.
Yeah, it'd be much better if it weren't on Twitter.
Obviously, yeah. But
now, have you guys seen or heard about the show Derek?
No. I mean, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it. And considering Gervais's, how shall I put it, caustic and abrasive style at times, I could see, bleeding hearts being offended, but maybe that isn't where this is going.
No. I mean, I like the show. For one thing, it's like a complete 180 from that.
From The Office.
Yeah, and just from his general public persona. Like, Derek is an incredibly sweet guy. I mean, almost like it's kind of the fault of the show that it's a little too pat, if anything, just in terms of like how saintly this somewhat mentally challenged character is.
Right, like mentally challenged people are not, they don't run the full spectrum. This guy's, because he's supposed to be an everyman of the mentally challenged, I assume.
I don't know if you would say that or not. But basically, like, anyway, but it's very clear that for Ricky, this character represents just like untrammeled goodness, you know, that he's just right. So he's kind of being the show, like every character on the show, like all the principal characters on the show anyway, all look up to Derek and they're like, oh, Derek is like the paragon of kindness and like what people should aspire to be. And I get the impression that that's sort of how Gervais, or there's a part of Gervais that feels that also, although it's obviously inconsistent with a lot of his public persona. he's been like tweeting a lot of stuff on Twitter with like Derek themed things and like, you know, be nice to people and the most important thing is to be nice and all this. And so he tweeted something today along the lines of like, anyone who enjoys watching animals suffer is a cunt. And I was like, well, you know, what happened to being nice? Would Derek call people a cunt? And then his response to me was, it involved calling me a cunt. and then, like, a bunch of Gervais followers have been, like, tweeting at me all day now and calling me a cunt also.
Yeah, you have a really voluminous interactions section on Twitter right now.
Oh, man. That is, man, what a brag. That is so sweet.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of this.
Yeah. This is easily forget everything we've been talking about up to this point.
This is my 15 minutes right here.
I wish I was I'm not even on a strong enough internet connection to handle both this call and bringing up the Twitter feed live, unfortunately. But yeah, fully approve of getting called a cunt by Ricky Gervais. Yeah, he does use that word a lot, though.
I think it's more acceptable in England.
Right. I was going to say, like no one bats an eyelash if you use bloody or bollocks, I guess, on your side of the pond. But Yeah, or apparently fairy, which I learned is really is like, I don't know how it is where you guys are, but fairy is like the most innocuous of terms. You use that for someone who mimics a poor performing ballerina jumping over a puddle, you know, like, but apparently that's like an invective in the UK. So it might be one of those cases, like cunt is like the worst, one of the worst words you can use in Toronto, I would think.
It's definitely considered like the worst one in the US. I think that's like the nut worst word.
Yeah. Yeah. So he like uses it all the time. Seems like.
I think he might have actually deleted the tweet.
Yeah, I can't see it. Wow.
No, maybe
it was something along the lines of like a person who like would confuse me with one of my, like only a cunt would confuse me with one of my characters, or it was roughly that.
Hmm.
Well, what a bummer. I should have retweeted it for posterity.
Posterity, possibly?
Posterity.
Or maybe also
did prosperity. I say prosperity?
Yeah, for friends. Well, you know they have that app that evaluates your Twitter account value, so it could still work, even though we all know you intended posterity.
I'm starting to regret my profanity-laced tirade against Dave Eggers.
It's absolutely staying in the show. I will put my foot down on this more than on any other point.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's wise for me to tone back the profanity a little bit. I've tried to do that. I am doing that only for people who confuse cute detail with actual sort of insight into the human condition. Only for them do I bring out the F word many times. So anyway, it's staying in the show. There's no way to, no negotiation here.
I feel pretty strongly about this. I found it hilarious.
it's a sore subject.
Really well, because I was reaching for the name. I was actually reaching for my Kindle. I was like, this guy, and then it was just boom. Fuck this guy. Yeah, I think you gotta keep it in. But I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm a fan. I'm pro profanity. So don't take my opinion on the matter. You know.
Yeah, it's really. I think. Yeah, it's a. I don't like postmodernism or anything generally, but I think.
It's too big of a thing to like either like it or not like it.
Exactly. And like, just because there's this horrible crap out there, people think that anything that involves sort of, you know, fractured narrative or, you know, forays into the sort of rich detail of commercial culture or something like that, sort of like long descriptions of small elements of commercial culture, like, you know, because there's all this sort of terrible postmodern art out there, people think that anyone whose work is anything like that is doing the same sort of crap as like the worst kind of postmodern. It's very bad. And certainly Infinite Jest is worth more than, you know, it's like, you know, Joe Biden said once that like he liked the train rides through Connecticut because he looked at all the cities there. I'm going to get this quote slightly wrong, but the idea was basically that, you know, he liked looking at all the cities because it was an example of something that was like inspiring to him or something. like the good of the city was just like as a thing to like sit there and inspire Joe Biden as he rode a train through Connecticut or something like that. Like it's the same kind of just absolute sort of misunderstanding of the role of great things in the world.
it just seems like there's a time and a place. Like if this Dave Eggers guy was like writing a biographical piece or like I don't know, like, you know, a memoir or something, but like this is the thing that's prefacing the text to everyone. I don't know. There's time for self-indulgence and self-reflection and even self-promotion, but this is like the opposite.
Yeah, you know what's great about Michelangelo is that it reminds me sometimes when it's Sunday, then I remember to call my mother because I call my mother on Sundays. And that's the good of Michelangelo, right? Is that it reminds me what day of the week it is sometimes. That's what it's good for. You know, it's like what kind of person would say something? Oh, God. Terrible.
I mean, I want to agree with you entirely, but I'm just thinking of all the times I've made statements to that effect in my life. It's considerable.
you have the good sense not to put them in the preface to the 10th anniversary edition of the NHS, though. Well, if Dave Eggers used to listen to the podcast, I think he doesn't anymore. So.
Imagine how surprised he would be if he
like, man, I came for the incisive poker strategy, and then
I didn't expect to be insulted.
Well.
Oh, they're talking about triple draw. Yes, I've been waiting 53 episodes.
Oh my, this conversation has taken a turn for the uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's well, I am willing to have him on the show if Mr. Eggers, if you're listening to the show and if you feel that I've mischaracterized your work, you're welcome to come on the show. We can hash this out like gentlemen, and you can call me any bad name you want to. That's my offer. If that's okay with you, Andrew.
No, encouraged.
All right. So if you know Dave Eggers, you can pass that along to him. He's been publicly insulted, and he's allowed to insult me in return or whatever.
Our friends and strategy sponsors over at Tournament Poker Edge have nearly 1,000 videos to help you improve your MTT game, some of them created by yours truly. Maybe that sounds a little overwhelming to you, like, where do I start? Which videos are the best for me? Well, they've just launched a new forum called TPE University that organizes the videos into courses that teach different types of skills and content. It's never been easier to make the most of the massive amount of tournament strategy available to you at tournamentpokeredge.com.
Well done, Andrew. So what's our hand today?
I just had in mind to ask Gareth some questions about Zoom poker. And
let me collect myself. Sort of
strategic approach to Zoom poker. I think the first one, Gareth, won't require a lot of collection, which is just, you know, what are your reasons for preferring to play Zoom over regular speed games?
Just the convenience of sitting down and being able to start a session, basically having no table selection concerns. It seems like a great time sink for me to invest in a table selecting routine algorithm and optimization strategy. And, you know, considering the fact that I just keep getting more and more busy, you know, that just seems like a huge undertaking to do. So I'd rather forego all that and just have equal opportunity to every player in the pool, basically.
And I feel kind of the same way in terms of like having the control over your, or just being able to start and stop very quickly, I guess. I find it works very well for filling up screen space while you're playing tournaments, because if you're a nit like me and you hate to sit out before it's your big blind or to sit in before it's your big blind, it can be difficult to coordinate your breaks with or to take a break from a cash game at the same time that all your tournaments go on break. So Zoom is great for that because you can sit out and sit back in pretty much instantly.
Yeah, just to add on to that point, PokerStars lets you sit out for half an hour while preserving your stack size and your entries in the pool. So one thing, there's two great things about this. You can take a break without, losing position on the fish or something like that. There's no concern about that. So that, I mean, over the years, that has helped me so much in terms of whether I need to take a shower or something or whatever the case may be, do a smaller task. On Full Tilt, they actually had it as an hour, and I would run, I would sprint to the basketball court, work out, sprint back, and hope like my 500 big blind stack was still there. But the other thing is, this is a little, you know, Zoom or speed game veteran tip for everyone, is there's a way where you can pay less big blinds per orbit, and that's basically by never starting and stopping a session. So the algorithm requires people to come in on a big blind, and the upshot of that is that at any given time, there's X number of people who must come in on a big blind. So the way to pay big blinds is to be sitting in and entering the pool. So like on Sundays, I only enter the pool four times per 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 hands or wherever the case may be. Over a million hands or something, I end up paying one big blind every like 6.1 hands, if that makes sense. Yeah, one big blind over every 6.1 hands, because yeah, stacks intact.
Have you calculated that?
I did. I did when I had my biggest database for my Full Tilt database, and it was something like that. Like I was making like 0.25 small big blinds per 100, basically, off this technique. By virtue of, like, I was literally playing, I was keeping, because Full Tilt let you do an hour, so I was keeping stacks on from like 8:30 in the morning until 8:30 at night, kind of thing. So I was only entering, I was probably like the highest, this is when I was like grinding real small stakes, so I was probably the highest volume like 25 and L player, but I was paying the fewest big blinds. I only had four entries per whatever 7,000 hands or 8,000 hands. Little edges, but definitely an edge, and it's still there. The possibility is still there with Zoom and PokerStars.
Do you feel like you've played enough regular speed games to make any kind of statement about like differences in terms of how the games play or how other people approach Zoom as opposed to regular speed games?
No, I wouldn't. I will, like, it's, that's a good way to put it, because I would say no to that. But I would say that certain things about Zoom, when I'm really grinding it out, I take advantage of people's misconceptions as it relates to transitioning from regular games to Zoom games. Like, there's just a lot of misconceptions about it being readless is the number one thing, you know, when actually...
I was wondering, like, how many hands do you have? For the people that you have the most hands on, like, how many hands is that?
There are players I have, like, 10,000 hands on.
Yeah,
and that's just in my database, the one I have now, which is not comprehensive, certainly, of all the hands I've played. The one I have right now, actually, I only got this computer in August of 2012. Yeah, so it's only like 18 months or something, or a little less, 15 months. So I've got 10,000 on two people, I think, and I do have like 5,000-6,000 on some other people. And there's a lot of people I have like 1,500 hands on.
So it really is a misconception that, like, there aren't reads and there's not game dynamics.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's a huge misconception. So when I'm, you know, I don't always do the best job of this. So, you know, I don't always practice what I preach. When I was, when my only avenue for income was poker, I was very good at this. And, you know, now I'm trying to get better or back to where I was in terms of habits. But note-taking is so huge. You can... You know, note-taking is like free EV. It's like free money if you want to take a note. But a lot of people just zoom on or whatever, and, you know, they encounter the same person in a similar spot where they could make an inference if they had made a note, and then they don't. And, like, note-taking is the kind of thing where you know, it's like you got to throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall before something sticks. But, you know, even if one out of 10 notes makes a crucial decision easy, like that's so valuable. And yeah, game dynamics matter a lot. Like, I know this guy did this last time, so I'm going to widen my 4-bet value range. And, you know, he knows my avatar is a big yellow smiley face and he knows me. So, you know, he's going to have in mind the fact that whatever, we played this hand before. Like, I actually used that to great effect in a hand. I guess it wasn't that long ago, but basically I 3-bet this guy from the small blind versus the button, double barreled an ace high board with a queen high flush draw that had a gut shot, and I rivered, you know, like the second nut flush, I guess, and I checked river, planning to check shove, but this guy instead bet like 105% a pot or something, so I just flatted because he was super polarized, and he was value betting top two pair for ace king. So so that was the hand, and then we played another hand where I 3-bet from the small blind versus his button, double barreled an ace high board with like a second pair to the board, which was a five on the flop, is like ace 5-2, and the river was an ace, and I checked, and he bet like half pot. And I turned my hand into a bluff with a check shove, which, like, at, I think it was at 50 and L on an ace, ace, X, Y, Z board in a 3-bet pot is like a huge no-no. Like, you should never do that. But the guy, like, 20 minutes before, one, I couldn't call, right? I couldn't call with just a five. But 20 minutes before, he had seen me check river with a huge hand. And then the key thing is, like, I called the huge bet he made, and he 100% thought he was winning when I called, because he had ace king on an ace king board, right? Like, he measured out the bet to 105%, pressed bet, and then was like, oh, call, you know? And then I was thinking about, because I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't check shove. So he's looking at the screen waiting for my timer to go down, and then I call with better, and he's like, what? So he obviously remembers that hand, and then like the exact same positions, ace high board texture, I took the exact same line up to the river and check shoved. You know, I don't know, it's hard for him to have error and not to have bet folded an ace, but you know, maybe I just got lucky and ran into, you know, a double float or something. But I feel like those kind of spots, if you're paying attention, like if you're actually really taking your time and paying attention, those spots are everywhere to be found. And that's just like a super illustrative example. People, though, don't take their time. They feel that because the format is optimized to get volume in, that they also have to optimize their own volume instead of, you know, like sitting back and taking it easy, letting, you know, it optimize your volume and, I don't know, just concentrating.
Yeah, no, Zoom is not a no-thinking form of, yeah, you actually are allowed to be patient in Zoom, despite yeah, exactly. The marketing.
Yeah, you can take your time on decisions, and people just don't do that, I guess.
When you talk about, like, making notes on people or taking the time to make notes, does that mean that you're routinely sticking around to see the results of hands that you're not involved in, or after you fold, you're not just instantly moving on to the next table, you're holding down shift or control or whatever it is to... Shows you how often I use it, that I'm not even sure what button it is, but yeah. The button that you hold down so that you can see the results rather than move on to the next hand.
Sometimes. I mean, those are going to be for three-way, like multi-way pots mostly, that's going to be useful because there's going to be some action pending that you would like to see. So, yeah, I would say the thing I do more often is I just sit out all tables when, like, I have a particularly huge decision. So I, you know, instead of wasting plies or whatever, folding deuce seven off on table one, I just go sit out all tables because I'm going to have to think about this river shove that's on table four. And then, you know, in the denouement of that, I take time to type out the note before I sit back in all tables. So yeah, anytime I have to take like an important note, I can just sit out all tables, or, you know, sometimes like I try and do it on the fly if it's, if I just have to press DNB for do not bluff in caps in someone's note, notepad or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. The sit out function isn't that, or the sit out and watch is only useful if, you duck out of the way and two people are still going to go at it and you want to see, you know, what ends up happening basically, which can be valuable for note taking, but doesn't, isn't as important as when you actually see showdown heads up against a reg.
Yeah, seeing how they play against you is more important than seeing how they play against someone else.
Yeah. And you're not guaranteed to see a showdown when there's a three-way situation with pending action either. You know, the guy might shove river and the other guy might fold. So even if you you're just not guaranteed to get a payoff by sitting out. Mm. Does that all make sense? I think, I don't know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Solid.
What about reads that you're getting off of a HUD? Like, what kind of stuff are you looking at on your HUD?
I mean, they're, I don't know. Usually a HUD, I would say, is best suited for the regulars who I don't have 1,500 hands on. You know, I'm sort of getting an idea of how wide does this guy open under the gun, stuff like that. I would say, like, a HUD is the starting point for me making exploitive plays. So if a guy's opening too wide under the gun, maybe I want to have a 3-bet range in MP. You know, if a guy is opening the button, I do have like button steal percentage on my HUD, so that gives me a starting point for what my pre-flop game is going to look like. And then there are regs who I just know what their game looks like, so I don't. You know, the HUD is more like reference for what I already know, I guess.
This is like the biggest thing that Snowy and I argue about is that it thinks I slow play big pairs too often pre-flop, but there's just a fair number of nitty people who I don't really want to be 3-betting in certain spots or 4-betting in certain spots. And then Snowy's out like, why are you flatting with aces? And because he's going to fold 90% of the time if I 4-bet him.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, people, there are a lot of spots in Zoom where people are doing actually a lot better job of this now, in even at like stakes as low as 50 and L, of not getting an ace king preflop. That sort of, it's very rare for someone to get an ace king with their under the gun range. People just sort of understand that they don't need to pile 110 big blinds in from under the gun with ace king off. So people were making that mistake even a year ago, but sorry, I just got pinged.
Tell me.
By a vast virus database has been updated. So I was flooding my ears. I don't know. I feel like stack off ranges in Zoom are by and large tighter than they should be. But then there are spots where people just lose their mind. Like basically in blind versus blind, people just lose their mind. And then there are spots where people are, you know, cold 4-bet heavy. So there's room to do stuff like 5-bet bluff, cold 4-bets. Still that no one really suspects you would do it light with like a bluff heavy frequency, I guess. But there are spots where it's pretty obvious that the guy button versus small blind versus big blind, like the guy was probably planning on 3-betting you if you're the button, or 3-betting the button if you're the small blind, and like you foiled his plan to do that, so now he's 4-betting you or 4-betting the small blind who 3-bet you. And it's like, it's pretty obvious that this guy had seen that, and then, you know, you can just, you know, rip it, or if you're deeper, you can, you know, put in a small 5-bet So there are still some pre-flop spots that, you know, a HUD is extremely integral to, you know, tiptoeing around huge disasters. But I think people are making less of those all-in pre-flop mistakes than they were in general. There's a lot of spots to like to fold ace-king pre-flop that I don't think existed a year ago. Folding ace-king pre-flop a year ago in my games, I could, it's like, yeah, this like 3/3/1 guy 3-bet you, like, okay, you can, whatever. But now they're coming up, I don't know, I do it once every other day, maybe, something like that.
Wow.
I feel like I found myself doing it somewhat more often than that.
Yeah, they definitely come up, yeah. I guess was my main. I don't know the frequency of it.
The last thing I was hoping to ask you before we let you go, is this is one of the biggest difficulties that I had, like going back and forth between Zoom and MTT. And I say go back and forth, but like I'm playing both at the same time. But I feel like there's kind of a different mindset to even among the player pool in Zoom, like because a lot of people are just oriented towards like, you know, move on to the next hand. If it's not a good spot, just like get out and move on to the next hand. And Zoom makes it so easy to do that. I there's just sort of that player, I guess there's just a disinclination to fight for pots. People are like, well, I could fight for this pot, or I could just, and half the time they folded before they even have a chance to fight for the pot. Like, you know, they've auto folded from the small blind before they even see that it was going to fold around to you on the button. And maybe they had a hand that they might've considered 3-betting your button open, but they just like auto folded the small blind instead. So I just feel like there's a disinclination towards fighting over pots in a lot of cases. And MTTs is really like exactly the opposite right now. Like so many people playing the WCOOP anyway have this like bulldog mentality of like, I'm going to fight for every single pot. And so I feel like the kind of the way you need to approach those is so different because, you know, on the one hand, you're kind of getting away with a lot of like either small or big bluffs, but just taking a lot of pots away from people in Zoom, and then it's much harder to do that in MTTs, or everyone's inclination is like, no one ever has a hand in MTTs. Is that something that you've encountered going back and forth between the two?
I was going to say, I have like the opposite problem because in Zoom, I really pride myself on, as Walter White would say, I am awake. That was a season 1 quote, so you might not get it. Like being very present and focused on the minutiae and the details. Like I stacked this fish for like 300 big blinds because like a 40 big blind stack opened cutoff and I flatted the button with aces with this fish in the big blind who was 300 big blinds deep with me. And like I had been probably playing at that point, I don't know, 10 hours or something like that. So I just really think it's super important to do the opposite in Zoom, to fight for all the pots, to focus on all the details. But then I noticed in tournaments, like, apart from, I guess, even the Sunday Million, like, pretty much every tournament I play regularly on Sunday, there's spots that come up in the mid stages or, like, in the money but not in the big money where I'm like, I want to make a Zoom play, basically. I want to, like, 5-bet on this guy. Or, you know, I, like, float this check raise with, you know, 2/3 of a pot-sized bet behind or something. And I'm just like, I just don't believe this guy. I just, you know, I just want to be a sicko right now. And then I'm like, Gareth, like, the blinds go up really slow and you have 40 big blinds and this is like a $22 tournament, like, you know, wait for a better spot or whatever, like take you, you know, you don't need to take this this spot. Like last time you did this with Queen Jack, the guy had aces, you know, remember that? Like that didn't feel too good. So yeah, I don't know, I think I have the opposite problem. That's probably just you being a better tournament player than me, to be honest.
Well, I don't mean that's the way I'm approaching it. I feel like that's the way all my opponents are approaching it.
Right.
Is like, right. And so it changes the way I play, though, because like in Zoom, I am doing like what you're talking about. I'm doing a lot of things to like represent big hands, and people are often giving me credit for them. And in MTTs, I feel like people never give you credit. Like if you anytime people are just like, you can't have, it's impossible to have trips. No one has trips. You can't. Yeah, if there's two of them on the board, you couldn't possibly have one in your hand. Like that seems like the MTT mentality, and I feel like people are way more likely to believe you at Zoom, and so I sometimes have difficulty, like you said, like trying, being tempted to make a Zoom play in an NTT when people just aren't going to give you credit for narrow ranges.
Yeah, no, I feel like of the sicko plays in MTTs I present with, I probably take 1 out of 20, and I should like very obviously be taking like 4 or 5 out of 20, but I'm just too much like, oh, you know, I have an edge of the field or whatever, whatever excuse people make to themselves.
Probably I should stop trying to take 9 out of 20.
Yeah, it's interesting dynamic, but I don't know. I guess I don't have anything particularly insightful to add.
Well, then we can thank you for coming on the show this evening and
or this early morning for you. I know it's what, about almost 3 a.m. now in Norway.
It's 3:30 a.m. in Norway. Okay.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. Definitely appreciate your staying up late to talk to us, and wish you safe travels.
Yeah, it's been great. I always enjoy it. We got some excoriating out of Nate, which is always a bonus.
Yeah. I'm making up for being very quiet in the last segment. So your poker thinking seems very good to me, Gareth. You're excellent. You're much better than Dave Eggers.
It's really fast from the podcast guy. Just click the unsubscribe button on iTunes.
All right, have a good day, girl.
Good night, Jared.
Yeah, good night, guys. Tapping on my window pane, feeling faint, feeling ashamed. Spread too thin and hoping for a sin, no, no, for a word that could take away the pain. Some kind of pill, or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.